Representative Ike Skelton, the senior Democrat on the House Armed Services Committee, was alarmed as he listened to President Bush point to Iraq, Iran, and North Korea as threatening adversaries in his 2002 State of the Union address. States like these and their terrorist allies constitute an axis of evil, arming to threaten the peace of the world, Bush warned. We'll be deliberate, yet time is not on our side. I will not wait on events while dangers gather. I will not stand by as peril draws closer and closer. The United States of America will not permit the world's most dangerous regimes to threaten us with the world's most destructive weapons. When the speech ended that January night, Skelton walked back across the hill to his congressional office and glumly told his staff that was a declaration of war. Skelton was a classic conservative Democrat from the heart of the country, representing a swath of 25 rural Missouri counties running from the edge of the Ozark Mountains north to the soybean fields along Interstate 70. The more he heard the Bush administration talk, the more he worried. The last of the Truman Democrats sensed he was about to be run over by the first of the 21st century Republicans. For George W. Bush was a bit of a revolutionary, having much more in common with the freewheeling 1960s than did Isaac Newton Skelton, a restrained son of the middle border. In the following months, Skelton would begin asking questions, including why did there appear to be no plans for post-war Iraq, and got few answers. For the next several years, his unhappy role would be that of a congressional Cassandra, his foresight accurate but disregarded. The next month, Wolfowitz trekked to Munich for the Verkunde meetings, an annual conference on security issues that brought together scores of top European and American defense officials and politicians. There, he confronted the contemptuous Germans. Countries must make a choice, he told them, about whether they would join the United States as it sought to preempt the threats it perceived in Iraq, Iran, and North Korea. He and Joseph Lieberman, the conservative Connecticut Democrat, whose mother-in-law had been held in the Dachau concentration camp just a few miles away, received moralistic responses from German and French politicians. Another member of the congressional delegation, Senator John McCain, the Arizona Republican, stood up at the end of the meeting to voice his support for Lieberman and Wolfowitz. The unified U.S. front seemed to make it clear the United States had Iraq in its sights. And it was going to be easy, some added. Rumsfeld's one-time assistant, Ken Edelman, sought to argue away worries about invading Iraq. I believe demolishing Hussein's military power and liberating Iraq would be a cakewalk, he wrote for the Washington Post's op-ed page in memorably provocative language. While Wolfowitz was in Munich, Central Command's rough draft of a plan for the invasion of Iraq began circulating quietly in parts of the Pentagon. The initial timetable was 1 October, just over half a year away, recalled one planning officer who was handed the document in an office of the Joint Staff one February afternoon. The plan led to a series of war games titled Prominent Hammer that sought, among other things, to judge the regional impact of a war in Iraq, as well as the strain that a war would impose on the U.S. military. Each game, a tabletop exercise in which likely second- and third-order consequences were gauged, took 3 or 4 days to play out, and each was followed by an in-depth staff analysis that kept parts of the Joint Staff working days stretching from 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. In the first part of May, the conclusions of the first two games were sent across the Potomac to the White House to brief President Bush. Essentially, the briefing concluded that October would be too soon to invade Iraq. There were two major reasons offered. First, the planning officer recalled, you got to set the conditions to lower the political risks of going to war by conducting an intense round of preparatory diplomacy. Also, there was a shortage of precision-guided weapons. We just dropped a bunch of PGMs in Afghanistan over the previous 6 months, and based on the combatant commander's statement, it would take several months to get back up to the level needed to go to war. In the wake of that briefing, the military had a sense that it had won some breathing room in the debate. The sense that an invasion of Iraq was imminent was undercut. The officers on the joint staff also thought they had given Franks the analytical results he needed to persuade Rumsfeld to go with a larger number of troops. "Rumsfeld is a great bureaucratic infighter," recalled the planner. "He's also not as doctrinal as people think." In this officer's account, Rumsfeld put on the table General Downing's plan for invading Iraq with just 10,000 troops as a bargaining move, done in the knowledge that the existing Central Command invasion plan, written under General Zinni, called for an invasion force of at least 300,000. What's more, Rumsfeld almost certainly knew that the invasion force ultimately chosen would be closer in size to Zinni's than to Downing's. But he was going to make the military fight for every incremental increase in the size of the force. "A lot of folks say the military rolled over for Rumsfeld," this officer concluded. "We didn't. We did the best we could."